You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 427 of the Columbia Calling podcast. My very special guest this week, coming in on segment three, is the writer, journalist, and I'd say philosopher too, art dealer as well, Juan Pablo Plata. He gives us a uniquely Colombian insight into the human experience through literature, not just Colombian literature, but also Anglophone literature. And we'll be talking, well, it all goes into politics and it all goes into the different extractive industries that take place here in Colombia. And we look at it decade by decade and see how sort of single source cultivations have really defined Colombian literature. And of course, we talk about Wade Davis, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Jorge Isaacs, and plenty of other things. And also something I knew nothing about was Colombian electronic literature. So there you go. It's a fascinating episode with someone who's really quite outspoken on all of these topics. And I can recommend his magazine, Colina Revista, and you'll find all sorts of interesting articles on there. You can find him on Wikipedia as well, Juan Pablo Plata. And he's on Twitter at JPP Escribe. So Juan Pablo Plata Escribe. So you find him there. We have Emily Hart back this week, of course, with the news brief. We're all going through, being overworked with the elections. Of course, remember the 19th of June is our second round of the Colombian presidential election. So all of us who are freelancers and journalists are working overtime towards this end. And from our sponsors, the Columbia Calling podcast this week is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. Also, this episode is brought to you by BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. So check out their website at bnbcolombia.com. Complete the free itinerary form and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So there we are. Offers from both of our sponsors, latinnews.com and bnbcolombia.com as well. Thank you again to our sponsors. Thank you again to our listeners, our Patreon supporters. Over to Emily Hart now and then on to chat with Juan Pablo Plata about all the aforementioned topics. So don't go away. Great episode in the making. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of June the 6th, 2022. The second round of the presidential election in Colombia is less than 2 weeks away, and the two candidates are ramping up their campaigns as they head towards the polls. In the first round, Gustavo Petro won 40% of the vote. Left-wing leader of the Pacto Histórico coalition, former mayor of Bogotá, and a former guerrilla with the M19 urban movement, Petro has campaigned on a ticket of social and economic change, including pension reform, free public university, and environmental policies. After a surprise boost on the final stretch, independent candidate, businessman, and former mayor of Bucaramanga, Rodolfo Hernández, won 28% of the vote in the first round, pushing out the expected second placeholder, Federico Gutiérrez, who won only 24% of the vote. Hernández has run on an anti-establishment and anti-corruption message, despite facing a prosecution for corruption himself. He is refusing to participate in public debates with Petro, campaigning largely on TikTok and on Twitter. Both Petro and Hernandez have been vocal critics of the current government, and the elimination of Gutierrez from the race is being seen as a blow to Colombia's political establishment. They are both anti-fracking and pro-reproductive rights, though Hernandez has drawn controversy with comments about a woman's place being in the home, dedicated, ideally, to raising children. Polls suggest that most of Federico Gutierrez's voters will transfer their vote to Hernandez for the runoff election, meaning the race will be close. Since the first round, the polls have repeatedly contradicted one another, with both candidates around the 40% mark. There is, as yet, no clear frontrunner. The legal decision to block two pilot fracking projects has been overruled by a higher court, meaning the operations will go ahead. The previous ruling was in favour of an Afro-Colombian group on the grounds that they had not been properly consulted, despite the fracking pilots affecting them. Since this ruling was overturned, there have been protests in the affected area of Puerto Wilches, Santander, and the group have said they plan to appeal. The FARC dissidences have confirmed the death of their commander, Gentil Duarte, saying he was killed in his sleep and blaming the Colombian state, along with the U.S. embassy. Gilberto Rodriguez Orejuela, former head of the Cali cartel, has also died at 87 years old in a U.S. prison. He had announced last year that he wanted to talk to the Truth Commission and claimed that he financed not only former President Ernesto Samper, but also former President Andrés Pastrana. Five people have been arrested for alleged involvement in the murder last month of a Paraguayan prosecutor whose work often focused on money laundering and drug trafficking. Prosecutor Marcelo Pecci, 45 years old, was shot dead on the island of Baru, near Cartagena, while on his honeymoon with his pregnant wife. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 427. My very special guest is Juan Pablo Plata. He is, well, where do we start? He's a writer. He's a journalist. He's an art salesman. Honestly, we've been talking offline now, and he's a wealth of knowledge of all things literature, all things art. I'd say he's also a philosopher, I'd say, you know, because some of the stuff we talk about, it goes beyond what is an ordinary conversation. And I put a tweet out there on Twitter saying, I'm looking to do something literary about Colombia and Bogota. And he jumped on the bandwagon. He jumped at the opportunity to say, listen, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about that. And so this is what we're going to do. We're going to talk about all sorts of literature, but also how do we put it into context in Colombia? How do we put it into context with each sort of decade? And how do we put it into context with how to get to know a country? So let me just say, Juan Pablo, thank you so much for your time, because I know you're a busy guy. You're writing all the time. You sent me links to your articles online. They're all on Amazon. And I've seen now on Instagram where you are an art dealer. And last week you were setting up an exhibition, I want to say in the Hilton somewhere. Was it the Hilton? I mean, you're a busy guy, but welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you for having me, Richard, and thank you for this nice introduction that you just gave to the listeners. And yeah, I mean, I guess I am the guy that you invited for this episode, but I want to ask you, before you start asking me, how did you get to know Colombia first? And if it was by reading some article or literature or in your geography class, and how the hell did you end up here?
Oh, it's a long story. My arrival in Colombia obviously is preceded with literature, of course. At university, in my undergrad, we studied Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Obviously, of course we did, amongst other Hispano-American literature, but also I studied, and it's today they probably wouldn't call the course the discovery of the new world, but it was called back then. So we're looking at the mid-90s. it was called the discovery of the new world. And of course, Colombia and the Magdalena River were very key. Might have something to do with how I ended up in Mompox, because Mompox as well, I learned about it at university in England. And I did a course which was all about Hispano-Arabic Spain. And of course, the connection to Mompox through the jewelry, the arabesque filigree, Mompox filigree as well, is connected. But Latin America always held a special place in my heart. My mother had spent lots of time in Mexico in the 1960s. My dad had lived in Brazil for almost a decade in the 1950s. And my stepmother had lived in Brazil, but in a different part. So my dad was in Rio de Janeiro, and my stepmother lived in Sao Paulo, like in the 60s, 70s, and I was an artist there. So there's always been something, you know, connecting me to this continent and this part of the world. And I knew pretty much every Latin American country before arriving in Colombia. And so it was just like, you know what, I have to go there, despite everything and despite my father saying, please don't go. I have to go there. And and the story sort of unravels from there. And there's, you know, then it's now, I was counting, it's almost 16 years here. Two children, married, businesses, projects that are successful, projects that have failed. But I'm here, you know, it's life in Colombia.
You had it coming. You had it was in you, Colombia, already.
Yeah, there was something, like they used to say here, there was something escrito, ya fue escrito. It was already written that I would be here. And now, you know, I did my doctorate and I wrote stuff for that about Bogota. And Bogota is a hard city, but I've really taken to it. And when my wife says to me, oh, we've got to go to this barrio and look for something, you know, I mean, repair stuff or something. I love it because I'm always going to find some strange thing that I would write about that's, I feel, is uniquely Colombian. Like you go to one place, it's like one place in Bogota, probably in Colombia, where you can find just screws. Not nuts and bolts and stuff. And he is the encyclopedia of this, you know, I love that. And I think actually, a friend of mine who writes, Vicky Kellaway, she had an idea many years ago to do a map of all the different barrios of Bogota, but based on their speciality. So like there's that, part of La Macarena where they only sell the paper guillotines, you know, the guillotine. And so that would be like the Guillotine Street, and then you'd go down to the 7 Agosto and to the leather area where every leather shop sells and makes leather coats that look like they're from the 1980s. They've all got shoulder pads, you know. And so I think we could there is a great opportunity to do something, but it's such a big job, you know. But anyway, so yeah, as I say, I've taken to it, and my thesis was about, you know, really getting into the depths of Bogota, making some comparisons with my home city of London. And I guess I have become very familiar with the city and appropriated it as my home. You know, or it has appropriated me.
I am marvel to hear what attracted you and what was that lured you to come here. And I was like expecting that you were going to mention Gabo, but one of the things that I wanted to bring to this conversation was that raw materials provided by Colombia are like the center of the most famous creations in literature, especially in fiction. Mm. No, in nonfiction, it has run differently, but as fiction, you talk about Maria by Jorge Sacks, that goes for sugar. As like the what
Voraje.
Yeah. The Vorahine with Robert, Gabo, 100 Years of Solitude with Banana. And obviously what you find is that these three novels, La Vorahine, Maria, 100 Years of Solitude, are a start point it's a good way to touch base if you want to get to know Colombia. Mm. But if you take a look at what is being written right now, you start to look at the same raw materials. Mm. But our only finished industrial product, which is cocaine, is finally being talked about and fictionalized. Mm. It is like saying that before this century, or before the last decade of the last century and the beginning of this, you started to see like a more open or wide open fiction talking about debt and money, which is what raw materials extraction cows. Mm. Either if it's sugar cane, either it's banana, because you might think of a banana production fully clean or as an industrial issue that has got rid of violence or dirty things, but no, it's not the case. Even Coca-Cola bananas. What I'm trying to say is that previously, a good way to know Colombia based on literature was to take a look at these three novels by Isaac, by Gabo, and by José Eustacio Rivera. Mm-hmm. But nowadays it gets complicated because we are narrating industrial finished product, either mm-hmm. what we receive imported, which includes weapons, mm-hmm. and our only finished product, which is the movies, series, and books, you know?
But I mean, as we would say in Spanish, this is a look into the monocultivo, a type of cultivation. When you say that, you mention bananas with Gabo, you mention Vorahines, the rubber, and of course, Maria is the
sugar.
But then could we have palm oil, coltan, obviously coca, cotton, petroleum, coal, emeralds? So could we say that each, you know, few years, I don't want to say each decade, each few years we see more fiction or nonfiction coming out that deals with these products, these extractive products, as the centerpiece for the fiction in Colombia?
Yeah, you can certainly say that. What actually happens is that the real action of humans happens first, as Aristotle puts it. Literature is based on what things are, what they could have been, and what they supposedly and how they supposedly happen based on the hearsay and all that. So yeah, like every decade is like being compromised with some topics and some raw materials or finished materials that we either import or export. Mm. But what is really important is also to think about humans traveling with the drain of brains, either for conflict or because people just want to experience a different country or culture, because you gotta be fair and realize that not all immigration cases are forced there are cases like you coming here to Colombia on your free will.
Yeah.
But free will has got a very tricky thing, as Christopher Hitchens put it. There is nothing else to choose. You got nothing but what other choice you got but free action as human. You know, is very paradoxical. But you only your only choice is to choose.
Your only choice is to choose.
But you came here as a regular traveler of world trotter, so to speak.
Yeah.
But this takes me to something else. I have read Sergio de la Pava. I have read writers like John Cañón. There is a female angel, is her last name. She writes from Florida. And all these writers have suffered like a sort of discrimination because some of them were born here or either were born there, but they are Colombians as a second generation type, and they sometimes, as Oscar Murillo, the painter, they get treated like they get to be mistreated because they are no fully Colombian. How come you get to be called a Colombian writer if you write from Florida, you write in English, and your short stories and novels get to be translated into Spanish after many months and years, blah, 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 blah. So I want to throw back an answer to you. What will make you a British writer instead of a Colombian writer? Your language or the topics? You know what I'm saying? Or where were you raised?
Yeah, I can't answer it. And it's such an interesting concept because I can imagine people like Sergio de la Pava and is it Ángela Engel?
Ángela Engel, that's right.
Ángela Engel, you know, writing from the United States, considered in the US being Colombian, and then considered in Colombian being from the United States, and probably being mistreated in both places, you know, probably. I don't know. Am I a British writer or am I a Colombian writer? But I write in English. So does that make me some sort of colonialist on this level? It's a hard one because my topic is Colombia, but I don't know where I would fit in truth, because one of the big issues I have is what I am writing on at the moment. Well, everybody knows who listens to this that I'm writing about more than 10 years of experiences in Mompós. There's all sorts of stories, but it's not travel writing. And as soon as I speak to an editor or try and get an agent, oh yeah, but travel writing is not selling very well. But on no level is it travel writing, because I'm really immersed in the society, and it's not like I'm just spending a week and then moving on to the next place and spending a week. This has been, you know, 14 years of Mompós. and it goes into the politics and the culture and the society. And so I want it to be a Colombian book, but accessible to British people or Anglophone people. I think that's how I feel, but I don't know. I haven't thought of the type of reaction that might arise, because in my experience, if I talk about politics, even amongst friends, Colombian friends, they're not happy that a foreigner might have or share opinions on politics. And I don't imagine this is unique to Colombia, but because I live here, I feel it. Do you have any feeling on this? Is because, you know, if I make, you know, and I have other friends who make opinions, strong opinions, immigrants to Colombia, who have got their Colombian citizenship now. I do not have it yet. And when they make an opinion, they are shot down, you know, verbally by people saying, listen, you can't say that. You don't know the country. Sure, they may not have the complete Colombian experience by being born here, but at the same time, you know, we're looking at maybe two decades of life, business, money, relationships, politics, and so on. Where do we decide where becoming a Colombian and where being an immigrant stops and starts. I don't know. I mean, you explore this. So I put it to you.
You know what? It's very important to take into account the readership and what has happened in politics and in general in culture with this hypersensibility, the Me Too, the chauvinistic, the protectionism of my country, my culture, Samuel Huntington, like saying the United States is getting crowded of too many foreigners. Remember what happened to Rome when the barbarians started to be more than the locals. So what I'm trying to say is that before taking these weird positions, you gotta realize that literature is made of the human experience. We are primates, and the global literature or world literature will be a better way of looking at what has been written in either in fiction and nonfiction. Is much better to see myself and to look at you, for example, as a human instead of looking at you as a British in Colombia. You know, what the hell are you doing here? Or if I go to live at Manchester and I get along with the culture and the teachers and Morrissey and all that, can I not be a Colombian British, a British Colombian? Should I could become one? Not the best Manchester guy, but probably a good one.
I love that you've referenced Morrissey. That makes me very happy because, you know, Morrissey reeks of Manchester. I mean, that's that. And to listen to Morrissey or to listen to the Smiths is to, you know, soak up Mancunian culture.
Yeah, but Manchester is no, but Morrissey is no anymore just from Manchester. No. He belongs to every human being, like literature. Yeah. You know, it's much better. It's not like you cannot take a position. Yeah, you can have your beliefs and your positions on any field, on any walk of life. But there is like how to put it, like a line in which you can handle and talk with others like I'm doing with you instead of building a boundary in which you say you don't belong to this, I don't belong to you. What gains more? What will give you more earnings culturally, money wise, to be open and to have a wider posture than this saying you're no Colombian, Richard. McCall, you're no Colombian. Yeah, I guess you're halfway of becoming a good Colombian, and I'm halfway of becoming a good British, probably in the future. But that's a much open and hospitable approach, you know.
I do like it, you know, when people say, "Oh, you've been here 16 years. Yeah, you're basically Colombian. Yeah, basically, but I can't vote because I haven't got my citizenship. So I will do that for the next election. I will have it before the next election." But so let's go back to this. If you were to suggest Anglophone writers to understand the Colombian experience, I mean the history and so on, we would talk about Malcolm Deas, David Bushnell from Colombia, a Nation in Spite of Itself, and of course Wade Davis, the Magdalena River of Memories, and of course the Runa River of Dream, and of course his One River about the Amazon,
One River,
which I personally prefer over the.
But I mean these books. Takes us back to something, which is raw materials.
Yeah.
If you read Wade Davis, One River, what Richard Evans Schultz is doing in the Amazon is looking for a single rubber plant that could protect the plants in Asia that were being planted and where the rubber was being extracted for the World War. I mean, it was like a geopolitical, very interesting, and it goes to show you the high pressure that these guys were. I mean, it's not Wade Davis talking about Richard Evans Jules taking sunbathing in the Amazon. It's not that the case. What Richard Evans Jules was looking for raw materials, the special tree that was not going to be affected by the plague and that could be planted in Asia and reproduce. And what you read in Bushnell and in this is also the terrible political relations that Colombia has engaged in sometimes with the case of taking sides, you know, like sometimes in the side of Israel or the States, or sometimes in the no alineados, when Samper was ruling Colombia and he took sides with Arabia, Venezuela, all these left guys. So what you actually see is that the best writers about our history in Colombia paradoxically are from outside. They are foreigners, but in the meantime they are also academic outsiders because they don't teach, they don't publish first here, they get translated, and that's when we read them. But they become canonical. They start to be read mandatory in our faculties, history, literature. So what attracts me is that if it is a matter of budget, you get more money up there, guys. So you get more money for books, more personnel, and you have more money is more time to do things too. You get a better salary and you spend it in that book. Or I don't know what other reason to explain this, but the best history written about Colombia happens to be written by Anglo-Saxons, these guys that you put it. And it also takes you back centuries. The best chronicles, especially no written, but at least draw or painted, were done by explorers from your region, Europe. They came here to describe the landscape, but also to describe the raw materials and what was at stake and available to exploit. I might sound like a neocolonialist and all that bullshit, but in the meantime, I want to sound like a nice revisionist, you know? Why is it that the best fiction, the most famous Colombian fiction, and the most famous history books in Colombia read for the past decades and that will be read in the future in a bookstore, in a library, or in the international universities happen to be these ones? You know, it's no, how to put it, is not without explanation. It's got to be that is well done and is done with a greater budget.
That's a really fascinating topic. Yes, of course, I would imagine, you know, that of course there's a lot more money in the Anglo-Saxon, you know, market, but it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, there's one thing that jumps out at me is that foreigners can write from outside. Obviously, they've come, they've studied, they've observed, but they can write having not been 100% connected, you know, having not been displaced, having not grown up within a liberal or a conservative family, having not, and so therefore they can look at it. I think there's always something subjective in writing anyway, by the things that you decide to write about, by the things you decide and to describe. But at the same time, you know, it's not an Antioquian saying to a Bogotano, we have a metro. You know, it's not, you know, they are able to separate these things a bit, and they are able to put it into context in a larger scale, and maybe into context with the region and maybe globally. Whereas things in Colombia, maybe, I mean, correct me, please, tend to be quite small scale when you study, but it's, you go into minuscule and infinitesimal detail, which is fascinating, but do not then maybe do not look at it as a whole in terms of, I don't know. I'm sort of rambling a bit, but I think there are advantages and of course disadvantages to the foreigners writing about these books, because on the one hand, they're not going to have the full experience from like what we've said, but on the other hand, they can perhaps write something that's more, that has greater longevity.
But I guess that also you gotta consider the amount of written production from Colombia, either history, academically, or how much does it get translated? So a quintessential experience of the Colombian could win or overlap the narrative of the foreigner, but there is one thing, and is that business and literature are mostly done worldwide in English.
Yeah.
So that's another way of looking at it. Mm. But I also agree with these minuscule things that we are able to produce in order to narrate ourselves. And it's got to do with our broken geography and our regionalism. Mm-hmm. We sometimes value or think worth it to take a local story, Bogota, Cundinamarca, more importantly than the Antioquian or the North Coast or the Pacific for certain agenda. I mean, you got to realize what's the agenda behind Laura Restrepo. Why she talks about the oil, the oil and gas industry in Casanare instead of talking about herself in Mexico or where she lives sometimes in Europe. You gotta realize that there is no literature and no journalism without an agenda or a minimum impulse. So I guess that this thing that we were talking about, that of who, which topics or which regions belong to, is like important. But what the enemies of you getting into the nationality or the race, for example, Richard talking about the experience of Afro-Anglo, Anglo-Saxon, Afro from Manchester or where are you from, Richard?
London. I'm a Londoner.
Yeah. So it goes along with this idea of what is untouchable because you belong to certain race, geography, institution, whatever. What you are really thinking when you are looking at national literatures or who is telling the narrative is what's the hidden agenda? Because sometimes it's wide open to people to realize it, but sometimes it's hidden. And it takes a while to realize what's there, you know, or what was the agenda that was hidden because part of it was open, and there is like also a thing that you make me think of is the anthropology and sociology studies. Mm-hmm. Either for Chiribiquete, either for Tierra Adentro, all that, you find the same phenomenon.
Is
written, it has been researched, well written and published widely and massively by Anglo-Saxons, Europeans. We do the research too, but we haven't got the spectrum to tell our ideas or to reach that, you know. It sometimes it happens that what we create, for example, in science, knowing cultural wise, gets this expansion. There was, for example, recently an invention of a camera for the whole body to cure the COVID after your body has passed that tunnel. Mm-hmm. And that really is going to be expanded to cure cancer and many other illnesses. And that gets reproduced like more easily because it's vital. Mm-hmm. But literature is never thought as a vital commodity for either for ourselves here in Colombia, because books are expensive, aren't they?
They're very expensive here. Books are very expensive. I have a question then about the regions, and because this is something that interests me very much. You know, I do come from Britain. We have our regions. They are divided, but I wouldn't say as much as here. I mean, you were born in Huila, but you did your studies.
No, I was born here, but I was raised in Garzón Huila.
Oh, Garzón Huila. I was just reading Wikipedia.
Don't worry.
So when you were raised in Garzón Huila, did they treat you as a Bogotano, having been born here?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I suffered twice being the newcomer, even though my whole ancestors were from Garzón Huila. I was treated differently by the accent, by the outfit. My likes, dishes, my sayings. Mm-hmm. And first, I arrived at 4 years old, and then I came back to study in Bogota. Mm. But at 8th grade in my secondary, I was expelled from a school, and the only school that my family found for me to finish 8th grade was back in Garzón. So I suffered in childhood and as a teenager this type of repulsion, like you don't belong there because you and they knew that I was going to stay from June to December, so to speak, and they really wanted to make me feel that I was a Colombian, but I was not from Huila, because I didn't know the folkloric songs, the steps of the music that we were going to be dancing at the last celebration of the school year, at the last day. But probably it was something that has got to do with the power of what is written, like Angel Rama, the power of the documents, and this is a centralist country which owes too much to the regions, and one way of the regions to have a payback is to mistreat the newcomers, you know? And I mean, it's no that logical, but I guess that is like a shield that they use to protect from the Bogotanos, because we rule, here is the government, here is that, and we have not been the best rulers of a country that doesn't end in the boundaries of Bogota or Cundinamarca. Yeah. This country is 1 million square kilometers, not a small portion of it, which is only Bogota and Cundinamarca. What we as Bogotanos have wanted to make out of it, you cannot make a do with Bogota for the full country, you know.
It's the same with London and that. But I think that's funny. You know, you were born in Bogota, then you were raised for a bit in Villa Garzón, then you returned to Bogota, then you were expelled, so you returned to Villa Garzón, and then you returned to Bogota for university, and they probably treated you as Huilense.
Yes, and I wasn't treated because I had the accent from Huila, and my outfit has changed, and I have to, so to speak, to start to find ways to belong to Bogota, to Los Andes, to El Centro, to the downtown. Yeah. And it's not that I wanted to betray myself, who I was and who I am. It was more a way of finding ways to communicate, at least, because Everyone is very protective in the regions. Yeah. You know, nobody. I mean, is something that you find out like these clans, like these gangs, but cultural or the stratification of the cities, they try to hinder you from something that they think they belong, that they are the owners of how to speak the. I wanna put an example. My two godfathers in order to become a journalist and a writer were Germán Espinosa and R.H. Moreno Durán. Two big nine names. If they haven't opened the door to me, I will be still waiting to be published my first article or my first book. So it goes to show you how regions block ourselves here inside the country, either as businessmen, either as cultural agents, art dealers, and it does affect us badly rather than good. I mean, the result is awful. What you are getting at the end is not much. And what you will accomplish by opening in yourself and being less an asshole with the Antioqueños, with the Costeños, will be bigger. I mean, if the gain will be bigger than what they are gaining what we are gaining as Bogotanos by putting this sort of boundaries, which are stupid. You know, what are we protecting? Jobs. Our girls, nothing valuable.
Imaginary wealth, but then of course monetary, but imaginary in a way, in the culture and so on. But
it's chauvinistic.
It is chauvinistic. You're true. It's that I read stories from your book, The Neon Occultista, but I also saw on an article you mentioned. A teacher from the Universidad Tadeo, Lozano Tadeo, Silvia Buitrago. I think I studied with her. I think we did our doctorate together.
It's really nice that you brought her to the conversation because we were talking about print literature, we were talking about the past, and we were talking about even botanic stuff. But I was missing something, which is electronic literature. Silvia Buitrago, Jaime Alejandro Rodriguez, and many other creators like Alejandra Jaramillo with Mandala. Many writers are engaged in something that is called electronic literature or ELO. As the abbreviation goes, electronic literature organization, or elite electronic literature. And what you might think is that is literature in a PDF, and it's not. Actually, electronic literature is literature that runs in devices, in the internet, or without the internet in an iPad. An Xbox, it can run in many places, and it happens to relay on text, but also on sounds, on video, on animations. And at first it was very experimental, but now it's a fully developed field. Just yesterday, the Electronic Literature Organization, ELO, published the fourth international anthology with at least 100 works. And Colombia is like a pioneer in that. Jaime Alejandro has published so far 3 novels. Silvia has published 1, and she teaches the students in Tadeo how to actually either do transmedia or these electronic novels or electronic poetry or electronic short stories. And it's quite amazing that finally being in this geographical position and in this epoch, Colombia is like finally up to date. You know, we are in some field. No, I mean, probably in transportation, in other fields, we are back. We have been left behind. But at least in these creative endeavors, we are up to date. We are doing electronic literature, and we are selling it, and we are producing it. I'm a researcher and a creator of that type of media too. But I'm missing many names and titles at these three. Don't suffice it. Look for Capitan Butrant too. He's a captain from a boat. Very, very nice character. Well built, and it also relates in all this media that we have at stake at our disposal. But what I wanted to say is that all these topics about raw materials took me here, like to talk about a finished industrial product. I'm gonna change my terrible words at the beginning. Colombia has more than one industrial finished product besides cocaine. We also have electronic literature and the camera of the doctor from Cali that kills cancer. We have six now. We're doing better now.
These things are all going in the right direction. I think maybe you're on account of, let's say, academics and creatives now trying to turn their back on what has been colonial history, colonial learning styles, colonial, you know, all this heritage of being a Spanish colonial, you know, empire. Maybe something like this electronic literature is the way of casting free from this, the original ways, you know, let's say the original. Now Colombia is finding its own feet in this. I think that's very exciting. I think that's very exciting that we can say, you know, maybe we don't have to look always to Europe and North America. We can actually look to Colombia for this. We can actually say, this is where it comes from. This is where it originates. And this is a new cultural phenomenon. I think that's amazing. I hadn't expected so much. All I was going to mention was that Silvia Buitrago was my classmate when we were doing our thesis.
She's on top of this phenomena of being up to date and producing, creating products either in for series. What she has developed actually is a transmit series, and the viewers are many, and it also has got subtitles. So what I will say is that Silvia and all these guys, plus the cinema movement, we are winning Cannes prizes. We are winning. Goes to show you that our intangible, what is not coffee, what is not, what is not copper, coltan, all that, also produces money, and is very sad to talk about literature without thinking of new possibilities and new possible worlds. You know, one thing that fiction and journalism gives you as a gift every time without you realizing it is that things could be worse or better. But there are many chances, you know, in these narratives. When you consume a narrative, the thing that gives you is that it could have been your case, but it also wasn't. I always go back to Aristotle, but it also shows you all these phenomena of how without any orange economic or an economic of any color painted by no color, can actually give ways of means for mm-hmm. make a living for a Colombian, you know, mm-hmm. for a person of the Western Hemisphere from Mexico down to Chile. You know, the phenomena is quite overwhelming here in Colombia because the creators are many. I again want to give apologies because I don't have all the names and the titles here, but I want you to go online and to look for Colombian electronic literature or literatura colombiana electronica, or literatura electronica colombiana, and to be overwhelmed by how good we're doing, plus Argentina and Chile, which are for me a little bit behind us, but finally we are finding a creative industries in order to exist, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like pretty good to find out that you as a scriptwriter or as a musician actually find a way to sell your music for an enterprise which happens to be a novel, which is no common novel, but actually a novel that runs in a computer, in an iPod, or in your iPhone. You know, it's quite nice to see that there are opportunities. You know, that things are no ready. It's just nice to find out that.
It's incredible. We're running out of time, Juan Pablo, but I want to ask, when we talk about opportunities and we talk about this, tell us a little bit about your art dealerships. Promote yourself now. Tell us quickly, where can we see some of the art that you are brokering, that you are selling?
Okay, thank you for this opportunity for self-promotion.
That's fine.
And I guess it's going to be tiresome for the listeners, but thank you, Richard. Well, normally you will find me on my Instagram page at Silver Editions, and also on Instagram by at JPP Escribe, which is... he writes in Spanish. Yeah. I guess it will be available in the links that Richard put in along the podcast.
Yeah.
But actually, you can just go to colinarevista.com or to add Silver Editions, and then you will find the current exhibition that I have available either in Colombia or in the States or in any worldwide fair. And mostly I rent a place in San Felipe neighborhood, in the Barrios Unidos locality. And I do either a collective or individual exhibition. And as I said, I have to experience the aesthetical emotion. Mm-hmm. And then I start to trust, to believe in the series, in the creations of a collective or either a singular type of artworks. Mm-hmm. but what I have found out is very special is that I was like finding my trade. Mm-hmm. Which is I'm gonna be a journalist, I'm gonna be a cultural journalist, but I end up being an art dealer. So mm-hmm. I get to be written about, oh, what a terrible exhibition, or what a terrible curatorship was this last one that Juan Pablo did, or that. So I get to ring the bells and to priest the, and to be the priest of the mass. I get to do both, you know, repicar y dar misa. I do both, and that's what I can tell you. I have had like some trouble with myself because I never expected to be written about or that my artists get in this criticism, and I get frustrated when they get bad reviews, you know, but is that how it goes? But that's more or less what I can tell you. There is a lot of things that I could tell. For example, that I like art that comes from good sources. Mm-hmm. I don't like to be engaged in money laundering. I don't like that either foreigners or locals get engaged in pre-Columbian artifacts extraction. That's bullshit. That's illegal. I wouldn't like to get nobody's jewelry from the national treasury. You know, how about going to Australia or to England to take the crown of the queen? How well do you like that? You know, that's terrible. So that's more or less what I can say, that I do well. I do clean stuff, and that I'm wide open to proposals from artists, emerging artists. I also can help you out to sell your antiques or artworks that you have collected. And I don't know, Richard, but that's more or less what I have prepared and thought of cover during these 45 or more or less minutes. Yeah. And please keep us updated on how you're going to publish your relatos, your stories on Pox, because we already know as a true fact that best Colombian history is written by Anglo-Saxons. So don't go away from that stream. Keep going upstream.
Thank you. That's very flattering indeed. And listen, everybody out there, check out at Silver Editions or at JPP Escribe. That's on Instagram. And let's take this moment to say thank you so much to Juan Pablo Plata for, we've covered everything. I mean, we've covered so much in there, and I knew nothing about Literatura Electronica Colombiana, and I'm going to start looking it up now, and I'm going to get in touch with Silvia. But let's just say thank you, because we really have had an opportunity to consider the human experience through literature, not only Anglo-Saxon or Anglophone, but also Colombian literature, and this sense of the monocultivo, or the products, the extractive products that have defined Colombian literature year by year, decade by decade. So Juan Pablo, thank you so much for your time, and surely we will have you back on some point in the future when you've got a new exhibition, or you've got a new book coming out, or you've got something you are angry about and you want to share it, because it has been a real pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you. And do not only do the Colombian calling, do the London calling too. It's great too.
Oh, maybe one day. But thank you again. We've been talking to Juan Pablo Plata. This has been episode 427. And some final words from our sponsors. The Columbia Calling podcast is brought to you this week by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And this episode is brought to you by BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. If you've been considering coming to Colombia, check out bnbcolombia.com, as the team there can provide you with a fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out their website, bnbcolombia.com. Complete your free itinerary form and tell them that Colombia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So again, BNB Colombia Tours, that's bnbcolombia.com, and Latin News, latinnews.com, our sponsors this week. Thank you again to Juan Pablo Plata for his time. This has been episode 427. We're back next week with more Colombia influenced interviews and conversations. Thank you again. Bye bye.